Thanks for listening to this week's Lefevre CFC podcast. Connect with us via our website, lefevrecfc.com, or our Facebook page, www.facebook.com/lefevrecfc. We hope you enjoy this week's message.
And great to see you all here. Good evening to you all. We have been doing a series, I suppose, on Old Testament characters. And I'm lucky enough to be able to be talking about Nehemiah, someone who you could probably do a 9-part series on Nehemiah if you wanted to. And he's certainly been a focus for a lot of conferences. You know, he's kind of held up as a model of leadership and civics and a whole range of other things. He certainly is a man of purpose, a man of prayer, and he's a very practical man. Okay, so for all of the tradies in the room, the good news is probably one of the men held up as one of the greatest leaders in the Old Testament was basically a well-organized tradie. Okay, he wasn't a priest, he wasn't a prophet, he wasn't a king, he wasn't necessarily wealthy, but he had a practical gift of using his hands, of organising, encouraging, very good with people. And it's very, very valuable. Now, I've got the thingo, haven't I, Danny? So I can probably self-drive here, I think. Thank you. But I think one of the traps that we can fall into is that we can kind of build this frame or worldview, if you like, of setting up these heroes as kind of the guides of a whole lot of things, for in the sense that it becomes self-help. Okay, so there are great principles, lessons to be learnt from studying the Old Testament characters, but we're not necessarily meant to imagine ourselves as those characters. For example, a classic, probably the most common example I guess I'm thinking of here is David and Goliath. You know, you've probably all heard motivational talks and sermons and things like that about slaying your giants. You know, what's in front of you? Just like David, you can knock it down. You just got to, you know, have courage and faith and all that sort of thing. But in some senses, I think we need to see ourselves as the Israelites, not as David. We need to see ourselves as in need of a champion, not as the champion if only we can just read another self-help book and, you know, have more courage. There is certainly something to be said for courage. There's certainly something to be said for those sorts of lessons, but it's not solely or principally about that. It's actually about a narrative pointing to Jesus. Jesus, our champion. David is a mirror of Jesus to come. Nehemiah is a mirror of Jesus to come. Nehemiah's name means comfort, or the comforter. I'm sure you know that there's someone else who's a comforter. And the Holy Spirit is here calling us as our comforter. We have a reminder, a visual reminder here of Jesus' finished work on the cross. Nehemiah, as a comforter, in that sense, is foreshadowing what is to come. So if, as Christians in 2020, we can put it in perspective, we start with Jesus the comforter and his finished work on the cross, and we can take the richness of Nehemiah's example. And it should turn us, rather than to say, what are the, you know, 8 pithy points I can do to sort of be more efficient in my day or get more productivity out of my team or, sharpen or polish my career, or, you know, because that is certainly one way we could take really important lessons from Nehemiah, and they're there. But it actually needs to start with Jesus and the fact that without him, we are without comfort. You know, without Jesus, we are without a champion. It's all about Jesus. It's all about the gospel message. So Nehemiah mirrors Jesus, who would come 400 years later. There was Nehemiah in the palace, completely safe, and he left all of that to identify with his people, to make citizens of a city, Jerusalem, to build a city and invite people to it. But of course, Jesus left all that he had and all that he was to identify with us, to make us citizens of the ultimate city. And without that, we're left with nothing but self-help and leadership principles. Isn't it incredible that we have both? What a gift that when we know Jesus, when we see Jesus, it all makes sense and it all pulls into line. Praise God. I can stop there now, can't I? I won't though. Okay. I think I forgot to do the rezoning, so hopefully we can read all the bits and pieces as we go, Danny. A bit of historical context about Nehemiah. And those of you agriculturally inclined, like Hayden, there's going to be some real points of interest here. You know, God laid out in his law some principles of Sabbath relating to the land. So if you were a farmer and you were cropping a land, that every seventh year you should give that area a rest and let the land regenerate. And of course, that's not just a principle from the biblical Sabbath, that one day a week that they should take a rest, but there's something about that for us, isn't there? That's certainly a challenge that I always have. How do you make sure that you have some time to regenerate? Now, the people of Israel got in a bit of a pickle. They got to a point where they'd gone 500 years and they'd ignored this principle of retiring the land every seventh year. And this was something that contributed to God's judgment. God continually was trying to call his people to draw them to him in obedience to his laws and his word, and they wouldn't do it. And he kept turning up the heat and kind of saying, look, you're not listening to me now. How about this, guys? And they wouldn't do it, and he kept turning up to the heat. And in the end, he said, well, if you won't obey my word, then I will cause the land to regenerate itself. And this is one of the reasons why when the people of Judah were exiled to Babylon, there was a prophecy that they would return in 70 years, because if you're very good at maths, you'll probably be able to work out that one in seven out of about 500 years is about 70. And so God has his way sometimes, even if we think we can manage our way out of obedience. Somehow God is sovereign. So there was a first exile. If you know your Old Testament history, you might know that the 12 tribes of Israel kind of separated after Solomon. 10 northern tribes, the Assyrians took them in 721 BC. And then there was a second exile to Judah. If we remember back to much earlier, when the people of Israel were in Egypt, Egypt was very cruel, and they were completely dominant over their, that they had people in absolute slavery and bondage. And God caused an exodus that was complete and it was instantaneous. Everyone went boom, gone, like that. The Babylonians were a little bit different. They kind of were a little bit more, they were gentler perhaps. They started by taking Daniel. So the courts, as Daniel and his buddies were just young, up-and-coming kind of rulers to be serving in the courts. So in a way, they kind of took the government and governance class away from the people of Israel and thought, okay, well, perhaps they can still kind of do their things and run their commerce, and we'll take their decision-making and power, and we'll kind of, gather our income and keep the power that way. But pretty soon that didn't satisfy the Babylonians. So then they took the craftsmen, which is a way to completely cut you off at the knees in an economic sense. That was a second group that they took to Babylon. And finally, by 586 BC, they took everyone. There were some that didn't return. Now, there are conjectures, I suppose, as to who is who. And the Jews out of Judah, that's where that word Jews comes, is from that southern kingdom, Judah. They were in Babylon, but there were others there who had Jewish heritage as well as other sort of affiliations and other intermarriage and things like that. In fact, one person I did a bit of research on this one was listening to a David Pawson analysis. He suggests that some of the opposition that we'll hear about shortly, Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, were possibly Samaritans. And if you can wind the clock forward 400 years and think about the relationship between the Samaritans and the Jews, it wasn't great in Jesus' time, okay? It wasn't great in Nehemiah's time 400 years earlier, if that analysis is correct. So there were three returns eventually. There was Zerubbabel, who was kind of like a king or a social ruler. Then there was Ezra, a priest, so there was a religious return. And then finally, there was Nehemiah, who brought a physical stability in restoring the wall. Ezra helping to rebuild the temple, and Zerubbabel also. So they built a temple but had no priests, brought the priests but had no protection. Nehemiah came and he helped to build the wall and to restore Jerusalem, which had been in ruins for so long. I think Nehemiah is certainly impressive. And, you know, he's a man's man. He'd be a nice coffee and whatever in the morning, no doubt, out on the site. But, you know, he was a prayerful man as well as a practical man. And he was an emotional man as well as a very strong social man. He knew how to gather people and to cast a vision, but he also grieved at times. And other times, he rejoiced. He was a very happy man at other times. He was also very strong in terms of the demands to return Jerusalem to be all that it was meant to be, that God had planned that his people would live in peace, but also in obedience to him. Nehemiah was pretty single-minded about that. I just want to read a little bit of Nehemiah chapter 1. If you've got your Bible there or your phone, grab it out. We're just going to do that first little section, Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 1 to 4. And you get a little sense of Nehemiah's heart and his passion here. In the month of Kislev, in the 20th year that Artaxerxes was emperor of Persia, I, Nehemiah, was in Susa, the capital city. Hanani, one of my brothers, arrived from Judah with another group, and I asked them about Jerusalem and about the other Jews who had returned from exile in Babylonia. They told me that those who had survived and were back in the homeland were in great difficulty, and that the foreigners who lived nearby looked down on them. They also told me that the walls of Jerusalem were still broken down, and that the gates had not been restored since the time that they were burned. When I heard all this, I sat down and wept. For several days I mourned and did not eat. I prayed to God. And I'll just add the very last line of the chapter. If we jump ahead, he says, in those days I was the emperor's wine steward. Okay, so that sounds like quite an odd job. Basically, his job was to drink wine before the king did, so that if it was poisoned, he would cark it and the king would be spared. Okay, so it seems like a pretty unappealing kind of vocation. But it also meant that when the wine was out and the king was there, he was close to the king. And so often the cupbearer or the wine steward was a very close confidant to the king, and that is certainly true of Artaxerxes, who they say is Esther's stepson, believe it or not, if you're into your Old Testament history. Artaxerxes and Nehemiah had a really close and trusting relationship. So he had a privileged position. He was embedded in the colonial power, if you like, or in the palace of Babylon. But something disturbed his spirit. And when he heard that Jerusalem was in disrepair and his people were unsafe, he sat down and he wept. Nehemiah was also a man of prayer, and there's some great examples in the book of Nehemiah. So if you kind of get the bug, do go and read the whole book. It's a very well organized book, as is Ezra. So probably Ezra wrote both, it's thought, and potentially I think Chronicles. Is that right? Chronicles, I think maybe it's one of them. I think it was Chronicles. But you know, Ezra was quite meticulous in the genre, if you like, and how he laid them out. So they're very well organized books, both Ezra and Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 5 to 11. This is one of the long prayers, but he also has very short prayers. Okay, so it doesn't matter that you have to be highfalutin and articulate for God to hear you. Although our tradie Nehemiah is articulate and passionate, no doubt about that. And he certainly had God's favour. So it's quite likely that something in Nehemiah touched God in an amazing way. So Nehemiah chapter 1 verse 5, Lord God of heaven, this is where he prays after not eating. Verse 5, you are great and we stand in fear of you. You faithfully keep your covenant with those who love you and do what you command. Look at me, Lord, and hear my prayer as I pray day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess that we, the people of Israel, have sinned. My ancestors and I have sinned. We have acted wickedly against you and have not done what you have commanded. We have not kept the laws which you gave us through Moses, your servant. Remember now what you told Moses. If you people of Israel are unfaithful to me, I will scatter you amongst the other nations. But then, if you turn back to me and do what I have commanded you, I will bring you back to the place where I have chosen to be worshipped, even though you are scattered to the ends of the earth. There's that regathering narrative. Okay, so see the mirroring of Jesus coming to regather us to himself. Lord, these are your servants, your own people. You rescued them by your great power and strength. Listen now to my prayer and to the prayers of all your other servants who want to honour you. Give me success today and make the emperor merciful to me. Okay, so he certainly has all of those things about boldness and courage. He has an understanding of the narrative arc of God, okay, which is the story, the long view. He knows it. He's calling on God to remind everyone, to bring them back. He's calling on God's promises, knowing that God is faithful and his promises are true. They're also quite long in some cases. Okay, so 500 years, the people of Judah, of Israel, did not follow what God had laid down. So God is patient, but he is also just. So something that's amazing here, there's this little picture here on the top of this slide. That's not right. Hang on. There we go. Little picture there. There was a subtext on the sort of clip art that said, Nehemiah prays a silent prayer before the king, and that comes a little bit later. So Nehemiah sits down and weeps, and then it skips to this story with a 4 months later, dot, dot, dot. Okay? And Artaxerxes sees Nehemiah, and Nehemiah looks washed out and miserable. He is in a wretched state. And Artaxerxes says, well, Nehemiah, I know you're not sick, so you must be sad. What's going on? Come on, out with it. Talk to me. Nehemiah prays a silent prayer and he says, how can I be happy when my people are in distress, when the city remains broken down and vulnerable, and God's people essentially prey to those who would harm us. And he asked the king for protection so that he can travel through some very dangerous lands, and he gets it. In fact, a garrison goes to protect Nehemiah and his crew to go and check out Jerusalem. Not only that, he issues some of his alliances kind of a blank check, really, to provide wood from the royal forests so that Nehemiah could rebuild and reinstate the gates to finalise the work on the wall. And I love this idea that Nehemiah didn't just go in gung-ho, right? So he was well-planned. He went and looked around. He spent time going at night so that no one would know, just checking the bits, seeing what the damage was, seeing what was needed, seeing what resources, what commitments from the people are going to be needed to get this job done. Now, already, Twitter was going crazy, all right? Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, who was said to be an Arab, the other two potentially Samaritans, they knew what was happening when Nehemiah, cupbearer to the king, went with a garrison and started, you know, with the Holden, Colorado, and a few trailers and some big bits of wood. They weren't silly. They knew what that meant. And so they started with mockery. They tried to discourage Nehemiah and the people initially by mocking them and making fun of them, hoping that that would be enough. It is pretty awful when you're in an early stage of taking a step to do something courageous and different, and people undermine you by making fun of you. It's not great, is it? That's what they did. They tried to discourage the people. But as I mentioned earlier, Nehemiah had incredible people skills. He was good with encouraging people, organising people, also having high expectations of God's people. And he was persistent. So family by family, once he set out and said, I know what we need to do, this is the plan, who's in? Everyone made their commitments and said, let's do this. And they started family by family, group by group, profession by profession. If you have a look in Nehemiah chapter 3 and 4, you'll see that there was a section of the wall that the perfume makers started to build. So, you know, you didn't have to be a tradie to get your hands dirty and build. The priests had a little section. The Levites had a section. The guy who was sort of, you know, a grain merchant. And it's all listed, all of the different things that people did in their normal lives to make money, they cast aside to do the work of restoring the city and restoring safety. So Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, the insults weren't enough. One of them said, even a fox could knock it down. Okay, you can think of what that sort of is. Mate, you couldn't build a wall if it fell on you. You know, whatever, you know. A fox could jump on it and knock the wall down, didn't cut it. They started to get worried as the wall started to go up in sections. Sure, there was gaps, but this thing was going up bit by bit around the rim of Jerusalem. So they had to kind of turn their mockery into threats. They started to kind of try and spook the workers and try and scare Nehemiah into stop doing the work. Now, I think there's some really interesting points. And if you remember, I think it might have been our last or second to last Zoom when Paul was talking about Joseph. He said there's some really interesting questions when you read these stories in the Bible. Do we believe that it's all of God? And that doesn't matter what we do, God is in complete control and he's going to have his way and we're kind of superfluous? Or is it that God gives us complete control and it's completely up to us? And that the burden and the onus of making this happen, this new city, this new heaven, if you like, new earth, is all in the power of our hands and our abilities. Well, I think both ends of that spectrum have real problems. One of them means that the self-help component of reading Nehemiah is enough. If we can just be excited enough, motivated enough, organized enough, you know, inspirational quotes to boot, we can do it because of the energy and the power and the goodwill. Of course, that's not true. Those things can be great, but they're not enough. And there's problems if you say, look, que sera, sera, God will do what he does and it doesn't matter about us. There are real problems about that. Paul certainly, the Apostle Paul in the New Testament, had to address some of those misnomers with Gnosticism and other things in the New Testament where people were kind of saying, well, you know, does it matter if we kind of completely live our lives in opposition to God because, you know, we're saved, we are assured in our salvation and it doesn't really matter? Well, that's wrong and highly problematic as well. Nehemiah, when the opposition came, he prayed. In other words, he's giving the ultimate result to God. He is recognizing that God is sovereign, but he also posted a guard. So he armed some of the workers, and they were in full armor standing out front to say to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, some of these opposition crews, you're not going to catch us napping. You are not going to run through us like a hot knife through butter while we're not ready, because we are watching you. And some of the workers had swords as they worked. Others who were carrying materials had a weapon in one hand and carried materials in the other. So Nehemiah was sending a very strong signal, a visual cue to those guys standing out there in the fields going, oh, I wonder if we can jump them now. Looks like they're organized. That's not going to work. So God is sovereign and what we do matters, I think, is probably the best way we can position ourselves when we think about that balance in the Bible. Nehemiah was an incredible man of principles. He outlasted and outwitted the opposition. He saw off their mockery. He stared down their threats, and still they continued to build, and the wall went up. The gaps began to close. The walls got higher and higher in sections. Then he had to deal with internal problems, and one of them was a growing inequity amongst the people inside the city. So some of these guys had probably run some fantastic businesses in Babylon. I'm sure the, you know, sort of al fresco dining and some of the options for you to run a business in Babylon was pretty good. And now they've made this commitment to come to Jerusalem. The economy's not so great. No one's really making money to buy your stuff because they're all building the wall. And by the way, so are we. So some people who had money began to lend to others on some very unfair terms. And some of those found themselves in negative equity and began to have to sell their children to foreign nations who were in the region in order to try and pay the debts back to their own people. Well, Nehemiah had none of that. David Pawson says that Nehemiah and Ezra were different. Ezra despaired and pulled out his own hair, and Nehemiah went and pulled out other people's hair. He brought people into the town and he said, what you're doing is wrong and I'm going to fix it. He was above reproach in that, as kind of the governor, he could have taken taxes from the people. He could have had them give their sheep and their cows and their chickens for him and his mob to eat, but he didn't. He made sure that his staff had what they needed, and he also made a commitment to not take anything from the people. So he was definitely a man of principles, of moral principles, and also of his own personal ethic, that he said, I don't want anyone saying that I grew fat on other people who are struggling and who are putting their shoulder to the wheel. We're all in this together, if you like to use a coronavirus era kind of slogan. So as you go through in Nehemiah chapter 6, they finish the wall, the gaps close, they haven't hung the gates, but it's really taking shape. And those of you who think that fake news and conspiracy theories and social media are modern phenomenons, I encourage you to read Nehemiah chapter 6, because the gates weren't quite finished yet, so there was still one more chance. So our brothers out on the plains of Ono, Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, they try a couple of tricks. One of them is to send an open letter, which kind of makes some pretty dodgy accusations against Nehemiah. Why an open letter? Well, it's a bit like sort of atting someone on Twitter, isn't it? Or sort of posting to their Facebook page with some spurious claims, because they wanted everyone to start going, oh, gee, Nehemiah, is he starting a revolt? We thought he was a pretty good bloke, but what's he really up to? Oh, maybe there's some dark web conspiracy about this bloke. Whoa, we better find that out, because apparently there's something going on. So it's a pretty old trick, that one. Nehemiah was pretty good about how he handled that stuff. He said, I'm doing a good work, because, oh, that's the other point, is that they kept saying, Nehemiah, we need to have a meeting. Okay, meetings are great, aren't they? They sound so neutral. They kept sending calendar invites. There's another thing that we didn't know was already in the Old Testament. Four times. Come and meet us on the plains of Ono. Let's talk it out, Nehemiah. But of course, they didn't plan to talk it out. They were going to rough him up or probably do away with him. And they were certainly having a last roll of the dice to try and stop the work from coming to completion. And I like this idea of Ono, because I think we've all been there to some degree. You know, sometimes, and this is where I sort of want to move to the focus, is that Nehemiah was incredibly uniquely positioned to do this work. To be able to stand before the king of Babylon and say, I need a garrison, Artaxerxes. I need some timber for free. And we're going to do this thing. Yes, okay, you did take all of us away and you kind of destroyed our city and burnt the gates and all that, but that was then, this is now. Help me out, bro. And he did. To get to that moment, I don't know if anyone else at that particular time could have pulled that off, except that Nehemiah was purposed to be there at that time. This is a bit of that idea of God's sovereignty and us having a hand in enacting God's purpose and plan for our life. You are purposed uniquely. There is no one in this room like you or me, thank goodness. I think Pastor Alan said that last week. But God has a unique purpose for you. And when you get to realize that, that is going to be both powerful, and to some people, that's going to be a threat. Because when power shifts, people get nervous. And when people feel like they're going to lose power, they get nasty. That's human nature. That's what happens. It's inevitable. It is going to happen. Okay? Nehemiah is not going to go into a region where their enemies, their hated enemies, have had 70 years of having a clear run of financially benefiting, of having access to all of those resources, of having complete power and authority. They're not just going to say, good on you, boys. We're going to take our pill and swallow it. It's not going to happen. It doesn't happen. It's not going to happen for you when you step out and say, I feel like it's time for me to say a silent prayer before the king and ask a bold request to do something, to step out in my unique purpose that God's called me to. People are going to call you to the plains of Ono. They're going to say, oh no, you shouldn't bother. It's just a lost cause. What a waste of time. You should just look after yourself. Self-care. Why are you worrying about others? Or, oh no, that's been tried before. You know, every man and his dog has done that. Never worked before. Why do you think you're going to be any different? Or, oh no, you're confused. You think you're on a righteous cause, but you're actually maybe a little bit crazy. Whatever. Okay, those voices are going to come and people are going to send you calendar invites to meet at the plains of Oh No. And you're going to have to take a leaf out of Nehemiah's book. He said, I'm doing a good work and I won't stop. And then he turned back to God. Okay, so there's that Nehemiah's hand, God's sovereignty. He's constantly moving back and across. It's really interesting how he sees that relationship. I'm doing a good work and I won't stop. Then he turns to God and says, now strengthen my hands for the work. You can do that too. God's calling you to fulfill your unique purpose. You're part of this church. In a way, this church is a little mirror or a little moment of God's kingdom here on earth. Jesus died for the church. The church matters. And here we are as a church full of people with a unique position, unique experiences, unique battles, and unique victories. Here we are. And God's calling you to step out. And when someone invites you to the plains of Ono, just tell them, you're doing a good work, and I'm not going to stop. And then you turn back to God and you say, now strengthen my hands for the work. Ah, I didn't change the slide. So that whole section was fantastic, wasn't it? There it was. And they get to the point, the gates are hung, the city is secure, the temple's already been built. Interesting, another little trick that they tried was to pay people who worked in the temple to try and confuse Nehemiah, to say, Nehemiah, quick, your enemies are coming. You should save yourself because you're too important, Nehemiah. We need you. Come and hide in the temple and we'll sort of lock ourselves in and we'll see them off so that they won't get you. And he thought, actually, that's contrary to God's law. I'm not going to put my own self-preservation above obedience. And that's about that personal character ethic again. And he found out later, of course, that Sanballat and Tobiah had bribed the temple officials to construct the whole thing, to discredit him in front of the people. But as the city's completed, Jerusalem is restored, and they invite people to come back in their thousands to fulfill God's narrative, that long arc, that plan that Jerusalem would be restored and his people would return. They begin by Ezra the priest reading the law. So they remind each other of what the game's all about. They come back to God. And the people confess, not private sins, but it's a public confession of national sins spanning 500 years, which is really interesting. So remember I said that they kind of had an inkling that there would be a return in 70 years because they knew that they hadn't done the right thing for 500 years. And so as Ezra's reading the law, they're reminded of how they got themselves in a mess and they're thanking God for bringing them out. Then they make agreements to obey the law. What an incredible day. In fact, Ezra said everyone should weep in repentance, and Nehemiah said, you know what, rejoice, because we've come through. He had a really great perspective. I want to finish with a little activity tonight, and this could be a private activity, but you know, we have, as Alan shared earlier, been encouraging you all to think about, what's my role here in the church? When I turn up for a service, what is my role? What can I put my hand to? Guys, can you just hand out these little things? I just want to encourage you as we go to this activity. If you're sitting here and you see a young person or someone that you want to encourage, that maybe God's already been prompting you to say, I really want to encourage this person in their walk, you might go and sit 1.5 metres away from them and just encourage them. What I want you to do is to ask this question. Nehemiah knew that his work was about restoring Jerusalem and drawing the people back to God's kingdom. And this is a transition. Think back to Moses. Think back to Abraham. Think back to David. It was about the man, the leader, the guy that spoke to God. Think of Abraham negotiating with God. God, if you could just find 50 righteous men, will you not destroy the city? There's one man standing before God on behalf of the many. But you see in Nehemiah a transition, a shift in mode, because suddenly it's not just about Nehemiah, it's about everyone. There's a definite transition in the structure of God's people in relationship with God. And we are in that moment where we are all builders of the wall. We're all doing that good work in contributing to God's kingdom. Everyone, whether you're a perfume maker or a fishmonger or a builder or a priest or a prophet, it doesn't matter. Everyone's doing their part. Nehemiah was just a very gifted coordinator. Everyone's contributing. And I want us to just think about that model and our role here and now. What does that mean for us? Okay, if myself or Zoe or Tara or Hayden or Paul or Alan come out this spot every week and we have the sort of the robes and everyone else just leans back and go, oh good, the man of God's in the house. I don't have to think. I don't have to do anything. It's all organised. Then that's a wrong thinking. Hey guys, can you just make sure everyone's got one? Just do a second. I don't want to say a second wave because that's a bad thing right at the minute as well. A second run maybe. Just put your hand up if you haven't got a text or a paper, right? I can see one, two, three. There's a few. Thanks, fellas. I want you just to ask yourself this question. How has God uniquely shaped you? What is the thing that you're going to step out before the King? You're going to say a silent prayer and say, God, it's time. It's time for me to ask boldly. It's time for me to recognize that I'm here for a purpose. So it starts with a purpose. Nehemiah starts with a purpose. His purpose is to restore Jerusalem and to bring God's people back to the city of Jerusalem. Of course, it's a mirror of what's to come. In fact, chronologically, Nehemiah is the end of the Old Testament because then it kind of goes quiet for 400 years. And then comes Jesus. So everything's set, but then Jesus comes to set up a new city, a new kingdom that we're all building and we're all called to participate and to dwell in that city, to belong, to be safe. And it's only possible because of the Comforter, not Nehemiah, but Jesus. Have a think. What is God calling you to? What is your moment that perhaps you need to see yourself in that Nehemiah moment to say, God, I know you're calling me. I need to take up a brick and I need to place it. It might be family by family. That's the way it was done in Nehemiah's time. It might be just you privately. I want you to write something on that brick. Now, if it's a personal thing, you don't want to share it, just draw a picture that you know what that means, just a moment between you and God. It might be a few things. It might be a few little images or words. What is God speaking to you about? When Nehemiah realized that God was tapping him on the shoulder and that his time to make good on his purpose had come, he sat down and he wept. And he stayed in that state for 4 months. He wept, he prayed. He knew that God was stirring something deep within him and that that was his journey, no one else's, just his. It was intensely personal. Jesus knows you personally. When he purposes you and gifts you and calls you, it's not about everyone else. It's between you and God. He knows you. He's calling you. What is it that God is calling you to in this place, in your community, in your family, in your personal maybe devotions, or you know, perhaps it's an issue of a personal ethic or something about the character. Nehemiah, you know, as I said before, what a great example he is. If you are after great leadership examples or great character ethic examples, they're all there. You can go and read it. Maybe that's an area of challenge for you. What I want you to do is to take your brick and then place it over here on the wall. I've sort of cleared a bit of an area over here. So just come out bit by bit. Rod, could you bring your team and just... I'd like to finish with the blessing which you sang earlier, which is great, because that's got that long narrative arc. That's an ancient Hebrew blessing from the book of Numbers. That's speaking God's blessing over you and your family, and it's an intergenerational blessing. So I want you to write down, what is God tapping you on the shoulder about? What is God in conversation with you about? What's the part of the wall that you can commit to starting on? What does the trowel look like? What tools are you going to need? How are you going to stand up when you get your calendar invites to the plains of Ono? It is good to ask those things, but to remember that God is sovereign and that God has purposed you. So when you're ready, I don't know what I've done with the blue tack. Was that in the case there, guys? There you go. There's some there. And we'll get that other bit there. Thank you. So I'm just going to pop this over here. Come and take your brick. And we may need someone practically minded to maybe, if we do want to make it sort of look like a brick wall, you know, if you have a look at these bricks, you can't just chuck them anywhere. You sort of got to... Maybe we need Bianca as a creative director or something to make sure everyone puts it in the right place. I don't know. But see if you can just sort of build something together, a patchwork of us as a church family. Because this isn't the church. We're just a local church. We're part of a global church. And the church over thousands of years. And we're doing our little bit. We're building our part of the wall together. So Rod's just going to lead us. When you're finished, just... putting your reflections down, just come and do your little bit. Put it on the wall.